And we're back. Speak Up Las Cruces. Walt Ruble, Peter Goodman co-hosting today. And we're still at 526-5825 if you have a question for our guest, who is Ali Scotton, who makes his money consulting with people who want to deal with Iran or do business in Iran. Is that a fair summary?
Well, businesses that are interested in doing business in the Middle East in general.
With the Middle East in general. Okay. And want to get your take on what's going on in Iran. I mean, let me start with the general. What would you, you know, if we were having a casual conversation on the train or something, what would you tell me first that we all don't know?
Well, you probably already know this, but the first thing we woke up to today was that President Trump said during the NATO summit that he thinks that the interim deal between the U.S. and Iran is over. This is a result of the past several weeks of Iran and the U.S. exchanging fire. And so,
are you surprised?
The MOU was already on shaky ground. Right. So just to give some background, back in several weeks ago, the U.S. and Iran signed a deal, an interim deal, to have a ceasefire and over a period of 60 days to come to an agreement on the nuclear issue, which was already a tall order because during the Obama administration, it took several years.
Right.
And in the interim, Iran has been attacking oil tankers in the Persian Gulf. Their claim is that the U.S. is trying to bypass a route that they control. And then the U.S. has been responding by attacks inside of Iran, and then Iran has been responding with attacks on U.S. bases in Kuwait and Bahrain. And so this tit-for-tat exchange was already going to be continuing through at least mid-August, through the end of the MOU. Now it seems like it's going to escalate again tonight. Trump said that he was going to engage in even stronger military strikes inside of Iran. We'll see where he attacks and then what the Iranian response will be, but it's very concerning.
We get almost no independent reporting coming out of Iran. Do you have a sense for what the – and I'm sure there are a lot of mixed feelings, but is there a prevailing feeling in the country towards America? And if so, what is it?
Sure. I think – I mean, first we can talk about support for the Islamic Republic government. I think it's continued to go down over the past, you know, decade because of the horrible economic situation and the political repression. You know, in January we saw the most extreme crackdown in Iranian history on protesters. And so there's definitely, I'd say about 10%, 15% of the Iranian population that is really supportive of the Islamic Republic. Now, when it comes to the United States, I think prior to this war, it was mixed. Mm-hmm. There was definitely a lot of people inside Iran. I've had my family is in Iran, and so anecdotal evidence, at least, of people who were just so fed up with their lives, lack of economic potential, that they just said, "Hey," there were people on the street saying, "Hey, we hope that, you know, Israel bombs us." I mean, this is not a common thing, but it is something you would hear. I think after the impact of what happened over the past several months, and especially from the Israeli side, the indiscriminate nature of the attacks inside of Tehran, the bombing of the Iranian girls' school by the United States on the first day of the war, I think a lot of people have woken up. Even that small majority of people who were maybe supportive of the war inside of Iran realize, you know, what the ramifications would be. And I think just in general, there's a lot of just a lack of hopefulness on the ability of regime change from the outside to take place, because as we've seen, you know, you took out the supreme leader and now you have his younger son.
You have a son who's not any better disposed toward the U.S. based on his father's death.
Right. And is not a couple of years from death himself.
Exactly. And so it's just a lot of hopelessness inside of Iran, I think.
Yeah, I can see that.
One of the questions one has about all this, Obama had a deal with them. The concern of, you know, there are a lot of concerns about Iran, including that they foment terrorism in other countries. But on the nuclear point, that they were trying to develop nuclear weapons, Obama reached an agreement. under what Mr. Trump has gotten so far with the war, are we better off or worse off than we were under that agreement?
I think it's pretty unequivocal that we're worse off, and that was the concern of a lot of people who follow the Middle East when Trump decided to pull out of the nuclear deal. Was this is mm-hmm. one of the potentials, is that international inspectors had verified during the – while the Obama deal was in place that Iran had no enriched – highly enriched uranium in the country, and that's the path you need to get to a bomb. And so when Trump pulled out of the deal and imposed sanctions on Iran again – this was one of the potential, you know, endpoints, and so now we're in a place where we are even worse off than we were prior to the war, where Iran has, you know, has realized how impactful the closure of the Strait of Hormuz can be on the global economy, and this leverage point that they have, and they're going to keep using that. On top of that, we have all this highly enriched uranium that is still, you know, underground inside of Iran, and yeah, the Trump has painted himself in a corner that he's in a much worse spot than he would have been if he had stayed in the deal in the first place.
Well, he had to undo anything Obama did. I mean, it sounds as if we not only lose the inspection, but while we've, you know, maybe bombing as he did a few months ago, set them back a little physically, he's given them a real motive. I mean, don't you feel – well, you tell me. You're the expert. Wouldn't you feel if you were the Iranian government, I got to get nukes because nothing else is going to work. I deal with these people and they do this.
Yeah, I think that's a big that's a big concern, and it's kind of – it's a this self-fulfilling prophecy basically of both the U.S. and Iran the U.S. and Israel, the way we've been – interacting with Iran over time, saying that they're an existential threat, they're going to be building a bomb, and dealing with them in a way that as if they were on the precipice of it, we've basically made it more likely by continuing to bomb them and proving to them that from their perspective that nothing we do is good enough. You know, we signed this deal with Iran, with the United States, tore that up. We were in negotiations with the U.S. twice. With Kushner and Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff, and Trump used that as a pretext to lull us into complacency and then attack us twice. Yeah. So from the Iranian perspective, inside of Iran, the voices who had been saying that there's no reason to negotiate with the West and we really do need to have this nuclear protection, that faction is really, you know, their arguments are really becoming more
salient. Of course.
Salient.
Why wouldn't they? Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about the Strait of Hormuz? And I think there's this perception here that a lot of people have in America, clearly the president included, that we are this big and mighty power, and all we need to do is, you know, flex or, you know, send battleships in. And why has that been so vexing? And to not only us, but it seems like the entire world, that a much smaller country is able to have that asymmetric of control.
Right. So the Strait of Hormuz is basically one of the big Achilles heels of the global economy. So you can have the most powerful military in the history of the world, but you have this extremely small passageway from Persian Gulf into the Indian Ocean that is where about 20%, over 20% of, you know, our oil and gas and even fertilizer and a lot of things come through. And so the strait is so narrow that from inside of Iran, it's very easy to attack ships. And not only do you don't even need to attack all the ships, you can basically threaten to attack ships, and then the insurance companies aren't going to be insuring these, you know, tankers with millions and millions of dollars of product on them. And so it's the Iranians have really discovered – I mean, they've already always had threatened this, but we pushed them to a point where it was an existential threat for them, and they've decided to take this action. They realized how easy it is, relatively painless or relatively costless it is for them to engage in this activity. And again, I think Trump had gotten bad advice. He didn't think that they would take this action. He also thought that the government would fall and there would be a revolution. And so now he's in this point where regardless of having the most powerful military in the world, this one small body of water has become his Achilles heel.
And it seems like, however this ends, now that Iran has that new power, I don't see them giving that up.
I was already skeptical about the potential for a long-term deal with this MOU if Trump continued to push for the Strait of Hormuz to remain an international body of water the way it was before with free passage.
Right.
I don't think Iran would agree to anything that wouldn't result in them receiving some kind of payment. Now, according to international law, you're not allowed to charge tolls, and so there was going to be some kind of, you know, fudging of the word that maybe these are fees for transit fees for upkeep, kind of like what they do with the Suez Canal.
Got to keep the water full.
Exactly. And so unless Trump agrees to allow for some type of payment that goes to Iran, going back to the nuclear issue, allowing some kind of Iran to claim that it can continue, that it has the right to continue enrichment, regardless of, you know, how little enrichment they're going to be conducting.
Right.
Those two sticking points, I don't think there's a prospect for a long-term deal.
Well, the other thing that we keep hearing about here is that every time there's a negotiation, Iran will send teams of experts. So they've got, you know, nuclear experts, military experts on every subject. We send Witkoff and Kushner.
There was reports that in the last round of talks, you know, when they were talking and Israel bombed them, Iran had been offering concessions that were actually very similar to what the Americans had wanted, but there's concern that maybe Witkoff and Kushner didn't understand the technicalities of what they were offering, and so it was a missed opportunity. The one positive step that I saw over the past several weeks was that as part of the MOU, both the U.S. and Iran were going to start sending technical teams, and so that was a positive step. Obviously, with what's going on, what's been going on in the past 48 hours, we'll see where the talks go, but that's the only way to even move towards a positive outcome is to have, you know, technical people talking about this issue that actually know what they're talking about.
Yeah, I'm sure you've seen the reportage on Netanyahu basically talking Trump into this in the Situation Room. I look at the world and, you know, figure, what are we going to do about Putin? What are we going to do about Netanyahu?
Yeah, I think it is important to mention, though, that if Trump was 100% against this, Netanyahu would not have been able to talk him into this. So he was already inclined, I think, especially because of the success in Venezuela. He felt invincible. There was no casualties. It was really quick and easy, and he thought that that's the same thing that could happen in Iran.
Well, it's another country that doesn't speak English.
No mush, no fuss.
Unfortunately for him, the governing structure of Iran is very different than Venezuela. It's a 40-year Islamic Republic. They've, over the years, since they came into power through a revolution, they've basically coup-proofed their own government by diversifying power, having a lot of backup plans if, you know, the top guy gets killed. It's not like in Venezuela or even Saddam Hussein where you just cut off the top guy and then the whole thing crumbles.
Iran also have a long-term reason not to like us too much. And you know, for people who haven't studied it, 1954, I think, they elect a progressive Mossadegh. I don't know if I'm saying his name right because I usually read it. But, and basically the British and the U.S. politicos and oil services – decide they veto the election, and they put in the Shah, who's more modern and probably had some good things to say for him, but he's a dictator and corrupt. That is what got us the revolution and what got us the hostage crisis. How much is that still a factor? I mean, years have passed. There are a lot of people, and most people in Iran weren't alive, or at least weren't conscious.
Yeah, I think probably for the general population, I mean, at this point we've had now a major war with the United States. So that's probably the main grievance that a lot of people have. But up until recently, that still was very important, especially for the you know, the Iranian government, the way mm-hmm. they saw the world. Up until 1953, when we overthrew the Mossadegh government, the United States was seen as kind of this benign, friendly force among the Iranian people. Mm-hmm. It was really the British and the Russians over centuries of meddling in Iranian mm-hmm. affairs. Those were kind of the big, you know, concerns. After that, with the reinstatement of the Shah, and then the Shah became more and more authoritarian up until the revolution, the United States began to be seen as the main, you know, infiltrator or the main country that was meddling in Iranian affairs. And so that, like you said, that was a major grievance that led to the Iranian Revolution. And then when President Carter decided to bring the Shah into the country because he was sick and he was going to treat him, that was the concern among a lot of the Iranian regime officials that this was going to be another coup. And so that's what led to the hostage situation.
When the president sends out a tweet on Easter morning, in the wee hours of the morning, saying that he wants to annihilate the entire civilization, you know, for most of us, we just kind of shrug that off. But for you, how did that land on your ears?
I mean, that was an extremely concerning day. I mean, Trump says some outrageous things, and you know, we were already in the middle of the war, so I was already extremely concerned. You know, with my family in Iran. It was tough to get a hold of them. You know, we just had to wait for them to call out when they got a chance to let us know that they were still alive, because there was bombing going all around Tehran, which my family lives in. But when he said that, there was definitely a lot of concern that, first of all, he was going to go after power plants and a lot of critical infrastructure. But, you know, at some point, you also have to be concerned about his willingness to use nuclear weapons. I mean, he's actually brought it up. There's reporting that he actually brought it up with his team about the potential of using nuclear weapons. And so that was an extremely, extremely concerning day for me and the rest of my family.
Very similar to what's going on with Putin and Ukraine, you know, that a leader gets into this crazy situation. And for the leader, nukes make the most sense because anything else is a loss.
Yeah. So, I mean, we have to see, I think, Trump... from the Iranian perspective, I think they think that Trump is going to try to at least ride this out mm-hmm. through November mm-hmm. to keep the situation pretty similar to where it is now, where there's more tit-for-tat strikes as opposed to a full-scale war like we had in the spring. But after November, there's concern that he could decide to escalate again.
I can understand that concern, but it still amazes me, because he has an interest in what will happen in November, and the high oil prices based on his war is not going to help the right thing happen from his point of view. Isn't he under some political pressure to get more reasonable,
yes,
at least for a while?
That's probably what brought him to the table to begin with, to sign this MOU. I mean, the oil prices were astronomical.
Well, we have a caller.
Oh,
so
right.
Let us interrupt you.
Yes.
And let us put our headphones on. And good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I'd like to address a situation which you're talking about with Iran. And if our ethnocentricity about Iran being kind of the bad guy always for 250 years, according to scholars in the area, if we flipped it around, would President Trump be charging a fee for the Strait of Hormuz? And
he says he will.
The reality of the situation, if it's gone from bad to worse, because Trump's punishing the economics of the global system to fund his friends. I mean, how much money does Saudi Arabia, AUE, Qatar make when the price of oil goes up like this? I think it's a bad deal all the way around, and your caller's family should be concerned. Trump would pull the trigger any time to make himself look big.
Should Thanks note that Saudi Arabia has figured out it does not trust Mr. Trump. And one of the recent times when he asked to use their airspace, correct me if I'm wrong, Ali, he planned a whole attack based on using their airspace, and then the Crown Prince said, sorry, you didn't ask us about that.
The Saudis realize that they have to share the region with Iran, no matter, even after Trump leaves. And so they're definitely concerned about
– Which is a huge change because they were pushing him to destroy Iran.
Right.
Not too long ago. Anyway.
To respond to what the caller mentioned, I think that, first of all, we can't discount the destructive nature of the current Iranian government. Specifically for the Iranian people, it's extremely repressive mm-hmm. government, and funds groups like Hamas and Hezbollah who engage in terrorism against Israel and mass atrocities inside of Syria. So this is not to say that the Iranian government is the good guys, but there's been over the past 40 years an inflation of the threat that is posed from Iran. The way that American politicians talk about Iran, it's as if we're talking about China. And that means that the way that we've interacted with Iran as an existential threat has really led us to where we are today, basically saying we have Iran is on the verge of annihilating us with their nuclear weapons or striking New York with their missiles. This is not the case. Iran wants to have influence in the region. It definitely wants the U.S. to leave the region, but Iran is not interested in attacking us with their military. Right. And so believing that, or at least using that rhetoric, has led us to attack Iran and engage in this destructive war.
Well, thank you, caller.
I think that's a good point, though, because I think we hear it all the time over here that, well, if they ever get a nuclear weapon, they're going to use it right away. And because there's this notion that because it's a theocracy, they don't think rationally like people in other countries do.
Like we do.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, can you kind of address that?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, if they were acting so irrationally, I don't think they would have lasted for 40 years, the Islamic Republic.
Good morning.
Good morning. My comment is that I did a short military tour in Iran in the mid-70s. And at that time, I had an insight that the Shah supporters were a thin intellectual materialism, but underneath, the vast majority were desperate to return to the 8th century. Now, concerning the conflict right now, consider all the chaos, destruction, savagery, brutality, oppression that Iran has imposed on the world. And if they get the nuclear bomb, do you think they will return to the Brotherhood of World Peace? They are, I just heard, a death cult, and I'm sure they would be willing to accept complete annihilation if they could destroy Israel and bring about the new caliphate.
So
that's my comment, and I hope you have a nice day.
No, are you still there? Can I ask you a question?
Apparently not. That's okay.
Okay.
Sure.
I all agree we don't want them, but Trump... Obama got us to where we had some assurance.
Yeah, he was giving voice to the question that I just asked you.
Yeah, so again, I mean, the Iranian government is an Islamic fundamentalist government. It has been engaged in atrocities across the region, and this is why we didn't want them to get anywhere near having a nuclear weapon. And the Obama deal was the best way to do that, again, because there was verifiable inspections that – kept their enrichment to a very, very low level. Now, after Trump pulled out of the deal, they have highly enriched uranium that's unaccounted for now. And so, that's a big concern. And so I think the best way to deal with a government like Iran is through tough negotiations and verifiable deals as opposed to going to war with them.
Yeah, can you just address the notion that they are a death cult and that they, annihilation of the entire world is new religious fanatic, that kind of
I mean, if they were to, let's say, if they were to get a nuclear weapon and nuke Israel, the United States and the other countries would annihilate the Iranian government, right? So if you're saying that they're a death cult and they would be willing to martyr themselves,
right.
They could have already done this. I mean, they could have, engaged in chemical warfare against Israel, and basically if they wanted to start this new Armageddon where the hidden imam or whatever would come back and it would, start the new caliphate or whatever. I mean, they could have already engaged in this,
right.
And they haven't. They've been more cautious up until recently. Now they're under existential threat from the United States, so now they're going to be a little bit more aggressive.
Yeah. Good morning, caller. Well, I'm hearing your radio. Are you there?
Yes.
Good. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead and make your point.
Yeah, well, I'd like to ask Mr. Goodman to address a point he made in his column, Let's Never Get Used to This.
I couldn't quite. I heard my name, but I couldn't hear the part after that. You'd like to ask what?
Let's Never Get Used to This, that column?
A column where you said, Let's Never Get Used to This.
Yes.
Okay. Basically, it talks about the inspectors general in the federal departments, and he's concerned that Trump fired dozens of them, Obama fired none, as if that's a bad thing. And what they were supposed to do is watch administrative departments for corruption, illegality, and waste.
Right.
Based on some recent revelations, I'm surprised that he shouldn't fire more.
I'm not sure what those are, but what's clear in the public, and I don't want to take too long on this. You can call, call me offline sometime, or call during the first half hour of the show when we're talking about various issues. This is focused on Iran, but it's very clear that Congress put in the inspectors general to watch over administrative departments, as you say, for fraud and waste and corruption. And they said you can't fire them without explaining to us why you're doing it. Not an absolute prohibition.
Man, we're down to our last minute, so let's cut this off.
To talk to you about that either first half hour when I'm on or off the show privately. But have a good day.
Ali, your last thoughts before we got to run here?
Well, we just, we're entering another concerning phase with the likely escalation over tonight with Trump probably attacking Iran again. And the only way that I see us getting out of this is if Trump finally realizes that he doesn't have 100% invincibility. He doesn't have all the cards. He needs to come to the table with Iran because Iran has a lot of leverage now. So hopefully someone gets to, wakes him up and he realizes this so that we can at least get some more stability in the Middle East again.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again, Ali Scotton, for being with us. And come back soon. There's a lot to talk about.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
But thanks again for being here.